This is Late to the Party, episode one.
Hello, and welcome to Late to the Party, episode one. This is the Geeks Unleashed new monthly book club podcast, and it's in addition to our weekly podcast, where on here we will work through what we have considered, well, not us, but what are considered essential graphic novels that we have never actually read.
That's right. So I'm Mark.
And I'm Jasmine.
And this week we are, sorry, and this month we are also joined by our guest host, Randy, who is the author of TV Never Sleeps, the TV editor of Goomba Stomp, and co-host and producer of the Mid-Season Replacements podcast. Thanks for joining us, Randy.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate you bringing me on for the inaugural episode.
No worries at all. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what you've got going on over at Mid-Season Replacements?
Sure. We're always doing something ridiculous. We're usually talking about Hannibal and Dare Me and all the shows that we're obsessed with. But our last show, we covered Utopia on Amazon. We also talked about the NBA Finals. And then the next coming weeks, we have a lot of stuff going on. We are covering The Haunting of Bly Manor. We've got an ongoing series where we're rewatching HBO's Oz. Yeah, I don't want to spend too much time on myself. A lot of stuff going on over there. We keep ourselves busy.
Brilliant. I listened to your Lost podcast the other day because I'm rewatching Lost at the moment. So I love that show.
Oh, my, probably, you know, if you put a gun to my head, that might be the show that I name as my favorite of all time. But, you know, in my line of work, I can never really have a consensus on that.
It's impossible to pick just one.
Oh, especially now, you know, with 80 years of television to build on, it's like pick your favorite athlete, you know, nobody can actually do that.
Yeah.
I'm probably coming back to this, really, like, there's just, me and Jasmine, we constantly say about, there's just so much content out there, like, coming out weekly, it's so difficult just to go back and cover previous stuff, whether that's graphic novels, games, TV, films, whatever, and that's why we actually created this podcast, because we're just so guilty of constantly looking at new stuff that we miss actually what is some really good old stuff, and we just said to ourselves, well, actually it'd be really cool to start a separate podcast, just a monthly book club, going back and reviewing stuff that everybody else considers essential and that we're just like, oh, it's like this book I've had of Mouse on my shelf for years and just never get around to reading it. So we've all got a copy of The Complete Mouse by R. Spielman, and it was originally published in serial format between 1980 and 1991. And the book itself, it covers a relationship between father and son, but set between sort of 1950s New York and slight little bit of Florida, and going back in time to World War II to cover their originally how his father and his mother met, and their journey through Poland as Germany starts to invade, all the way through to the Holocaust and obviously the concentration camps. It was obviously a difficult read for all of us, I would imagine. But actually it's a book that's been well recognized and has even won a Pulitzer Prize. So I sort of enjoyed it, but equally found it quite sad to read. So I guess my thoughts on it really are that it's quite a topic that I probably would never have considered picking up if it was just a novel, but reading it like this in comic book format is something that actually has sort of touched me and made me appreciate this kind of story that I would never have considered reading before. What about you, Randy?
Well, you know, I had an interest for a long time in World War II. So I read Mouse for the first time sometime in the late 90s when I was, 12 years old or something like that. Wow. Really enjoyed it then. But it was kind of hard to have a real objective point of view on how it utilizes the medium to tell its story. So revisiting it now was interesting, both and reflecting on how it tells its story about the Holocaust and its characters, but also, like you said, you wouldn't really consume this if it was a novel, but as a graphic novel, there's a different appeal, there's a different expression there. So I found it really interesting to kind of deconstruct why Mouse took the form of a graphic novel and a comic book. And it's, you know, not just because, Art Spiegelman was an artist, but it's an interesting work, though I think my relationship with it, my reaction to it now is a little more complicated than it was back then. I don't think it's quite the like genre defining work that that it was lauded as it was in 1980, but you know, we can get into that as we go through the show, but still a very compelling piece of work.
I thought it was, as weird as it is to say, the medium is what made this palatable. I think the closest film I can think of that reminds me of this kind of story would be something like a Schindler's List.
Nobody watches that twice.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly what I told Mark before we started. I was like, I've seen Schindler's List, and once is all it takes. I will never, ever watch that movie again. But there, even parts of this graphic novel were hard to get through, like especially in the second book toward the end when, you know, they start talking about the details of the crematoriums and they start showing the, you know, the mass graves. And it's like, yes, I understand this is a graphic novel and these are mice, but at the same time, I know exactly what this stands for and what this means. So I just, like you said, I couldn't imagine reading this in any other format if it wasn't like mice and cats and, you know, just animals as opposed to seeing actual dead human bodies piling up.
I think the format actually really did help with this story, though, because there's like a page where they're telling it's part of World War II, and at the same time, you're getting really into it, and then suddenly it breaks away to Art and his father, where his father tells him off for spilling cigarette ash on the carpet, and you're like, you know, pulls you back into the present. And I think it's clear that obviously father and son had a difficult relationship by, you know, this huge void between them in, well, probably in age gap, but also in terms of the different upbringings and what Vladek went through in Poland in, you know, in the Nazi invasion. And obviously Art's actually been brought up in America to a much nicer lifestyle. And, you know, seeing throughout the book, what I quite liked was a lot of the conversations felt really raw and real. And actually, something that really took me back was constant fourth wall breaking, really, where he doesn't outright address the audience, I didn't feel, but it did feel a little bit like that, as in him. Well, there was one point where he did address the audience, but most of the time it didn't feel like he did. But it's kind of where he's also talking about, oh, I need to go and write this conversation down. And actually just feel that genuinely he did take away real conversations with him and his dad. And I like the fact that you could have a page where half of it was World War II and half of it was 1950s New York. And you wouldn't be able to do that if it was just a normal novel. So,
well, I think the thing that's really interesting to me about the relationship between father and son and how it's portrayed in the book is, you know, Mouse is really, you know, it's about the Holocaust. It's about a father and son, but it's about the idea, you know, there's a lot of medical research now that goes into the idea of inherited trauma and how trauma can pass through genes from generation to generation. And I don't see a clearer reflection of that than in how both father and son are just obsessed with the past to the point that they miss the picture of the present. You know, the father does it both with his obsession with the way that he used to have to live his life and the habits that were formed, you know, the way he holds on to everything and doesn't want to spend money and the way he's cautious of people that care about him. And quite frankly, and one of the more striking things to me upon rereading this book was how his son is also obsessed with the past, both in how he was brought up by his father and how that caused issues in their relationship, but also how he's, a lot of the book is about when they set things in modern times is about how he's kind of obfuscating the importance of what's going on with his father's health because he's so obsessed with getting this story. You know, there's a section in, I think it's the fourth chapter of the second book, when his father's like starting to get really sick and he's asking him, hey, can you help me put these storm windows up? I got to get my storm windows up. I can't pay extra money for heat. I can't do it by myself. And the son's so obsessed with getting the story written down so he can write the second half of his book that he puts that off and then wears his father out telling stories. So at the end of the day, they don't get the thing that needed to get done accomplished. And I think that's, I don't know if it was really conscious on Art's part, but one of the things I really took away from my reread of it was just how much these two men missed in their lives in the present. I think Mala's character is a great example of how it does it with the father, but with the son, it's just how he misses the signs from his father of what his father's going through in the present, just because he's so obsessed with his own mission to get this book published. And I think it's, there's an interesting point of contention that, that you and I have, Mark, with that fourth wall breaking, because if there was one thing upon this reread that really stuck out to me as not working, it's that fourth wall breaking material. Some of it just feels, quite frankly, really self-aggrandizing, how he's, you know, talking to the audience about how he doesn't know how to finish the second book and has to justify to us why he defines his French wife as a mouse. And there are just times where it feels like I felt that the language he was using as himself to kind of talk to the audience took away from what the story was really about. And the story is about his father, and him injecting himself into parts of the story that don't involve his father felt out of place to me rereading it.
I actually agree with that part. Because the whole first chapter of the second book is, like you said, it's him trying to write it, talking to his publisher, talking to his editor, talking to his wife. And it was weird, because in the first book, I loved all of the conversations that he was having with his dad. I liked the in-between parts where it was kind of like, oh, let's walk to the bank, and oh, let's do this, and oh, I got to get on the roof because the roof is broken. I really need you to help me with that. Another thing that kind of caught me at the beginning of the second book was you could suddenly see that he was now wearing a mask. Because in parts of the first book, when they're trying to pretend they're Polish and not Jewish, you can see that they're wearing the pig masks. The mice are wearing the pig masks to pass themselves off as the Poles. But in the first part of the second book, now Art is wearing a mouse mask as he's talking to his editor and as he's going through these kinds of things. I thought that was an interesting kind of shift in perspective, how now he sees himself wearing a mask as opposed to drawing himself as a full mouse.
And there's that full page shot of him drawing art for the book with the mask on top of a full body, all these piled up bodies of dead mice.
Yes.
And it's like, are you trying to say that you're adopting a culture that you don't feel like you're a part of to tell this story? Or all of a sudden, all the laudatory awards and stuff you got in the first part got to your head, and now you feel like you have the responsibility of 6 million dead people on your back? Because it's interesting, because the big dichotomy between the two halves is as the art gets better in the second half, the writing gets worse. The art in the first half it's fine, but there's nothing that really stands out to me. But some of the multi-panel work in the second book is really striking. And the way that comes through in the tone was kind of off-putting for a while in the times in the second half where they get away from what's going on in the past.
Yeah, it's almost like his arrogance kind of takes center stage in the second book, as opposed to the first book, where you're just engrossed in the story of his father actually surviving all of this stuff.
Yeah, there's no reflection in the second book. That is completely lost on the half of art, art's perspective.
Yeah. Okay, I see. I thought maybe I was just reading too late into the night, but I definitely felt there was a huge, huge shift between the first book and the second book.
Oh yeah, when I said about the fourth wall breaking, I liked more what I enjoyed was that in the first book was the interactions by father and son. But yeah, in the second book, where it's I think a good 10 pages or something are just the son and his wife, really. And I was I don't care as much about this. I wanted to read about the actual story that we were actually in here to read about. I did enjoy the father and son relationship, which we were seeing a lot of. But all I could wonder was when the book finished, the reason I sort of thought maybe they did that was from how was he going to end the book? Because he obviously, it changed chronologically. He kind of started the second book with the death of his father, really. And then he sort of then went back and then told the whole story, without then showing his father dying. So he goes back and it's again chronologically told differently. He then tells about how his dad and his mother eventually meet up after the war, and that's the last page. So when that ended, I did think to myself, maybe he just didn't want to then after that sort of go back to the present with the dad dying of a heart attack. Maybe he wanted to give it a bit of a sort of a nicer ending, showing his mother and father reuniting after years of being separated from the concentration camps. That's all I could think is how they maybe put that together structurally. I mean, again, it does take away from it a little bit, and is a little bit self-gratifying for himself, but I don't know, that's kind of just thought maybe they just altered it for structure.
Well, and he shies away from the one moment of joy that those books, both books, have to offer. And that's the weirdest part about the ending, is it just happens. You know, one page they're separated, the next page they're together, and then the next panel, the whole thing's over. You know, 250 something pages to get to that final panel. And while it is a striking moment, because it does end things unresolved between father and son. But, and you know, I don't need a Hallmark movie ending to it, but there is something to be said about how abruptly and how uninterested it seems he is in the actual resolution of either of timelines in the book.
I mean, it makes you kind of question, like, you were so into getting this story at the beginning, and then at the end, it was just kind of like, okay, I'm done. But
what it became what, art I mean, story, and I think that's why that ending feels so abrupt and
almost unsatisfying.
Yeah,
I think book one versus book two, I preferred book one. I preferred really just getting into how he met Anya and his first girlfriend, and I quite enjoyed that. Like, and I preferred it more when we, to see it. Yeah, it seems a bit bad, I guess, but I didn't really enjoy as much seeing the father and son as I did hearing about the father's story. I preferred to see the father's story. Yes, it was good. I did like seeing the father and son, but I actually preferred to actually just hear about the father's story. I wasn't as interested in Art's story, like, especially in book two.
What I did about the overall book is my only reading comprehension of the Holocaust is in school we read The Diary of Anne Frank. So getting to see sort of, it's almost like a memoir, right? Like, this is sort of a firsthand account of what happened, what they went through in the camps and that kind of thing. So it was really interesting to have that perspective. So I enjoyed getting to read it from that point. And there was one point toward the sort of the middle of the second book where Art finally asked his father, like, you know, you guys seem to have a lot, you knew how to get around in the camps and you knew who to talk to get what you needed in the camps, but why didn't more of you resist? Excuse me. And he's like, I mean, his dad's like, well, what were we supposed to do? We were starving, we were scared, and most of the people couldn't even believe the things that they were seeing with their own eyes. What kind of resistance were we supposed to put up? And I think just being able to ask that question, it kind of shows my privilege of being able to, you know, we're currently in a time right now where resistance is about the biggest thing that, you know, we have going for us. So to try to apply that logic to something that was happening back in the 1940s, it was a struggle for me to understand while reading this whole book, like, why wasn't there more fight? Why wasn't there more resistance? Why didn't you try harder, I guess?
Yeah, I remember when I read that comment, actually, I did think back to, because there's sort of half page and page scenes of 200-300 Jews all lined up with, I don't know, 3 or 4 soldiers around them, maybe a couple on the walls. So the Jews did actually have the numbers in those concentration camps, but they wore them down so much. And you could see that throughout the book, you know, like feeding them soup and a tiny bit of bread once a day and then getting them to work so hard and sleep on floors and that. They probably just didn't have the energy or in the fight in them, and they were so scared to be that one to get the bullet. And although, actually, I did think by reading this, Vladek, there were parts in the book I did feel he came across actually as very intelligent. He did have a sort of a survivalist instinct, I felt. You know, one point he can be a tin man, then he can be a shoemaker, and finding all these different survival mechanisms in the concentration camps to try and get through. But I did also feel that a lot of it was just luck. I just never really considered what people would have to go through in these concentration camps to survive.
I think even more shocking is how the story really captures what happens to the Jewish culture and how, like, just Vladek's entire sense of identity, both personal and, you know, his religious identity, are just stripped away from him over time. You know, the book begins, he's part of a fairly prominent family. He's going to marry a woman from another prominent family. He has his own factory. He has a business. He has plenty of the people, you know, he collaborates with other people in the community. And then as time goes on, as the book carries through its first few chapters, his friends start leaving, people start turning on them, they have to start hiding. Just the way that they are systematically broke down as human beings is, it's striking. And like Jasmine said, you know, there are definitely parallels you can draw between what's happening to the Jewish people there and what happens all over the world now in any number of circumstances. It's really powerful to see characters return later on in different chapters and have them like abandon each, see families abandon each other or get separated, to see members of the community that Vladek trusted turn on him in like times of crisis is really powerful and speaks to, again, the intergenerational trauma that so many people that live through the Holocaust have, where how can you have hope when members of your own community have turned against you in self-preservation? And you think about all this stuff happening in the 30s, you know, a lot of Vladek's story takes place in the late 30s. You know, the traditional Western powers didn't enter the war until the early 1940s. So when it feels like the entire world is ignoring your plight, it fundamentally changes who you are and how you approach things. And I think there's no more striking use than the separation of the two time periods than what we see of Vladek in the 40s and the late 30s, and then the Vladek that we see now in the early 80s. I'm not the biggest fan of the time jumps because I think Art inserting himself constantly throughout the story is really frustrating and annoying. But having, if we have to trade having Art there to get that perspective of who Vladek became, I think it's worth it because it really, it fills in the space between the ending of the second book and kind of the beginning of the first one in interesting ways.
I thought that reading of the people turning on each other was probably some of the hardest stuff to read in the book, just because it was like, but you all worked so hard to get here. You worked so hard to come up with this plan. You worked so hard to do all of these things. And then to just kind of, it was like systematically, they just, it became every man for himself. And it's hard enough to read. I can't imagine what it felt like to go through that, to literally put your life, or in their case, to put their first son's life, Richelieu, in someone else's hands, and then for you know, for everything to just kind of fall to shit. It really kind of sucks.
Yeah, because you know the cold open at the beginning, you know, it's about people turning on each other, because there's this, obviously, that weird sort of cold open, those just first two pages before he gets into the story. I think it was, he's 11 years old and he's complaining to his father about friends, and his dad says, you know, friends, your friends, if you lock them together in a room with no food for a week, then you could see what it is, friends. And like, and that obviously plays out later on in the book as we go into it, about when they are in the concentration camps, about how, I think there's a scene later on about how one of the prisoners accidentally knocks another one and spills some soup and basically kills the other person or beats him to death, pretty much. And yeah, just how the whole thing is turning them against each other. It is hard to read it, let alone, I can imagine being there would have been even worse. So, and when you mentioned about friends, people coming in and out of it, I found that actually quite interesting, because they'll have moments of the book where Vladek's talking about a rabbi, and they get on a train and you see them spend a bit of time together, and then they get off the train and he's like, and that's the last I ever heard of that rabbi. And you can imagine, like, it got me thinking about how this is pre-technology and pre-communication times, and how sad that must be, that actually this, how displaced families and friends were throughout this. And they've been at the book, Vladek sort of covers off a few, where he knows where a few of his family or friends ended up. And it's quite sad, just the whole, how they had this nice, you know, wealthy life, and then World War II came along, and seeing actually how people became every man for themselves in some ways. And then at the end of it, just how, where they all ended up.
Yeah. I think the that's the one place that the framing of using different characters as animals works, as you know, the subjugation of Jewish people and their identity. I think using mice in that situation is kind of interesting, you know, considering the role that mice play, say, in the medical society or something, where they're forced into a role and an identity that they really have no say in, or a construction of, for, you know, no ability to construct an identity for themselves around that kind of life. I don't really think the animal framing as a whole works. It's not super consistent in parts. It doesn't really... it's very limited in its use, and I don't think that like having like Nazis be cats and Jewish people be mice is a particularly like intelligent take on it. You know, it's like, okay, we all read Animal Farm when we were kids. Yeah, like, yeah, we get it. Like, we understand how you're gonna, like, there's nothing creative really happening there. I think it's just mice are easier to draw. And I'll give Spiegelman credit. I think the work that's done with the art to convey emotions through the face of the mice is fascinating. You know, probably the most touching shot in the entire book is when Vladek is talking about how his eye had to be replaced and how he still had the ability to cry out of that eye. That was probably the most striking panel of the entire book. And we're talking about, you know, the minimalist drawings of a mouse that they've used throughout, you know, the 250 pages, but it works. I don't think as a whole, though, the animal framing really works as a whole, either as like an allegory for like how these people were represented in society at the time, or in just a way to kind of pacify the narrative. Because I think the more striking image would be seeing humans do this to other humans. When you separate it out and you have cats doing it to mice, or you have a bear doing it to a pig or whatever it is, you're drawing lines there that I think kind of blur the most difficult parts of the reality to face are. Maybe this is the only way that it's palatable, though. You can't, you know, there are plenty of people that can't even sit through the entirety of Schindler's List because you're watching humans commit atrocities against each other. But I think it's such a, it's not really a unique human circumstance through life, but the Holocaust is such a represented, visited, important part of modern history that it loses a bit of the edge. And I think that edge is necessary and something we really should be hammering home as we pass from generation to generation. Curious what your thoughts were on the kind of the art design of the characters in that book.
Yeah,
I was just going to say, but do you think that it could have been as acclaimed as it is without that? I mean, do you think that it could have still been this kind of, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Not popular, but I mean, but do you think it would have gotten as far as it did critically if it was people instead of animals?
I don't think it would have, because I think at the time the medium wasn't respected enough where you could do something like that. I think now you can accomplish that kind of thing. It just feels, I think reading it in 2020, that it feels a bit simplistic. You know, I was reading some reviews of it, contemporary reviews and also old reviews from when it first came out, and speeches people had given, and just lauding him for this crazy intelligent allegory that he defines between mice and cats just kind of made me roll my eyes and remembering that people didn't take it seriously as an art form until, you know, books like Watchmen and Mouse came out in the early 80s. I don't think it would have, but I also don't think that it necessarily, the text quite has that impact that you would like it to have. But maybe that's just me and I'm just addicted to misery or something. this, like you said, it's, this may be the only way to make it palatable for a larger audience. And that's what they're looking to do here.
I was going to say, when I read this, because I obviously was thinking about the art style, and he, even again, before Fall Break, and does reference several times throughout the book about when he goes back to draw it using animals, and even makes a reference about how he's actually putting real cats and dogs into the book, and as well as using cats and dogs to be the image of humans. I did get actually thinking about that. Would this work to humans as I was writing it?
That makes no sense.
well, I guess what would he have done? Had humans on leashes?
There's a scene of the mice, and they're looking and they're talking about the rats on the floor. So then they start complaining about the rats on the floor. And I'm like, are you trying to say something here? Or is this just you ran into a corner with your art design and now you have to justify it in some way?
I think probably he just had thought, crap, I've used these people as my... he's like, he obviously wanted to reference it because I suppose it was important to Vadek and Anya that they are staying in several horrible places with mice or rats, but actually they're mice themselves. So really, if they were mice themselves, rats wouldn't have been that big a deal. But obviously these were humans showing pictorially as mice. I did think that, and actually it's quite weird. So as I was reading it, as I tend to do, live in a house with two kids, my 10-year-old walked past and said, why am I reading a book of animals in? So from a kid's point of view, they just see me just reading a graphic novel with animals in. And that actually did take me out of it as I was reading it for a minute, thinking, actually, would this have been different if it was humans? And, you know, you said about George Orwell's Animal Farm. When I was reading it, this was the only thing that I really compared with. So I know that was a novel, but I read the book, but I also read, I also watched the animated movie of Animal Farm, which obviously was all animals. So I did think about that as well when I was watching this. And those are the only two things I can really think of that have really taken quite serious, you know, conversations and turned them into, I guess, used animals as a way of telling their story. And I don't think
that Zack Snyder movie, The Legends of Cthulhu or whatever.
I haven't seen that.
Please don't.
The Legends of Garhul. The Legends of Garhul. I've not seen that. It's something I keep thinking about watching though. But as I was reading this, because when my daughter said to me, oh, why are you reading a book about animals? And I was like, it's not about animals.
It's about
real animals.
Yeah. But it did get me thinking, like, and with Jasmine, your question about would this have worked for humans? I don't think it would either. I think the mice was actually the initial hook. Like, and actually it's, you know, it makes a good title, Mouse, but I think also the illustration of mice in this World War II setting probably made it easier for people initially to read. Like, and you said, I've actually not seen Schindler's List, but I've seen many a violent film that is quite hard to watch sometimes, human on human violence, and this probably helped to maybe soften that blow so that he could tell his story. That's sort of my take on the art form.
I actually felt guilty at the beginning because I, and Randy, you've mentioned it earlier, the simplicity of the drawings. So like when I first started reading, I was like, am I missing something? Like I'm following along with the story, but like, I mean, it's just mice wearing pants. Like this is, I don't see this as some, oh my God, this art is amazing. Oh yeah. So I did, like, the art is not kind of what drew me. And as I read, I noticed that I wasn't always paying attention to the artwork. I just kind of, once I got into a good stride, like I was just reading and not really looking at the pictures, so to speak.
Yeah, me too. The art for me wasn't a big thing.
Not until the second book. Now, in the second book, it started to get to the point where it was like, you know, you had the bodies piling up everywhere, and it started to get a bit more graphic and a bit more descriptive in the actual artwork. So I did pay more attention to the art in the second part of the book, but in the first half of the book, I basically just read.
Well, the art is more interesting in the second half. I think the medium is used more effectively in the second half. The first half is really just kind of a long narrative stretch. You know, it's just a lot of retelling, and the focus is very, you know, text bubbles dominate those panels. And the second half, there's a little bit less language, a little bit more of the art. And I think while, you know, I have my issues with the writing of the second half, I think some of the art in the second half is really striking. You know, that multi-panel shot going down the page of Vladek, like, bent over looking at pictures. And that stuff really works well to give some breadth to the story that, you know, I guess the first half doesn't necessarily need, because it's not quite as dynamic what's going on. The events of that are happening are a lot more dramatic in the second half. Mm-hmm. But you can feel the time that was spent between these two volumes being published and in how the writer and the artist's tone changed throughout that.
Go ahead, Mark.
So one of the things I did like about the art was not to do with the characters, but when I liked it when there's a scene where Art and Vladika are walking along talking, and they're talking about how they hid in like a storage container, and all of a sudden the bottom half page is like a sketch of his notebook actually, and it says side view and explains like the bunker and actually shows how they would have hidden behind a false wall, and actually it's actually illustrated. I did like how they had that illustration showing actually how these people had to hide behind a fake wall and underneath a coal bin just to hide away from the Nazis. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting how he would drop in like diagrams that were drawn by someone else. That was a neat way to present the story. I think with the first half of the book, how we're saying it's not very striking art-wise, but the first half of the book to me was, I found it to be incredibly like insidious, the way that everyone could see something was happening, yet everyone kept choosing to ignore the signs that things were going in a very wrong direction. And I think the first half of the book really, really got to me because I couldn't help but draw those kinds of parallels to the kinds of stuff that we have going on now, where it's like, you can see these things happening. People are telling you that these things are happening, but if you aren't seeing it with your own eyes, it's very easy to be like, oh, I'll be fine. Like that's happening to them, but yeah. I'm okay where I am now, so I'm going to continue to be okay. And so I think for me, just getting through the first half of the book, it was kind of like, this is not gonna end well. And I just kept thinking that to myself as I was reading, like, you guys have no idea, this is not gonna end well. You can't just sit there on the sidelines and say, oh, it's happening over in that city. it's not happening in our city, or it's happening to the, you know, the poor people are experiencing this. It's not going to happen to us. We're going to be fine. And I thought that kind of underlying like slow burn of watching this horrible thing take shape and nobody kind of doing much because they all thought it wouldn't touch them. That was,
yeah, then you turn around and all of a sudden they're taking the Polish people and the Hungarian people as well.
Exactly.
Into the camps, and it really brings that point home.
Yeah, and it was one of those things where it's like, it doesn't matter how rich you are. Like, sure, you've got this diamond engagement ring or you've got a gold watch, but that can only get you so much. Like, you're literally trading your gold for bread, you know?
Yep. I mean, you're being told to sell your business and then being forced to walk away from it and getting $0 out of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I found it surprising at the end after Vladek and a friend that he knew before the war had actually met up, and they went back to where they used to live, and they're telling a story about one of their friends went back to get their bakery, but another family had taken it over, and, you know, this is Polish people versus Polish people now, like they've taken it over and basically killed the guy who used to own the bakery because it's ours now. And there's a few sort of instances that they reference about people just taking over people's properties, and that's it. It says, you know, like, you know, the Germans have been horrible enough to them, and then they also add to it. So and then at the end as well, after the war, they mention, you know, sort of coming to an end, or, you know, so they've said it's finished, but Vladek hides underneath some boards at the back of someone's house, and she shouts out to the Germans, there's two Jewish people back there, and, you know, it felt like she didn't need to do it, but just did it anyway. Like, and luckily those Germans didn't care and went off. But yeah, no, it was quite hard to read that people just turning on each other just for survival. It's quite depressing, really.
And so, you know, that whole story takes place across like what, maybe at most a 15-year period. Mm-hmm. So to see how the norms of civilization can be completely broken by one twisted ideology is, it's a reason that we teach, that we should teach accurate history classes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah.
So I had one, if you don't mind, I had one thing that I wanted to bring up for you guys that we hadn't talked about. I know it's your show, so I hope you don't mind. But I wanted to talk about the two unspoken women of Maus and Anja and Mala, because I think this book really wants to say something about these two women, about their places in Vladek's life, about their, to a degree, I think that's more important to art than kind of who they are as characters themselves. But it's kind of striking how little perspective we get. I understand that, you know, getting Anja's perspective, given that she committed suicide and Vladek burned all her diaries, kind of limits that. But there's so much unearthed material to be found in, you know, because for all intents and purposes, this is a story about a man's journey through Nazi Germany and Nazi Europe as kind of a whole in the 40s. And having his wife's perspective be a little bit more central, especially in the first book when they're still together, I think would have been beneficial, because Anja's character kind of has to inform Mala's character a bit, because as we know, you know, Mala lost family members to this. She went through this experience as well. So she's equipped to deal with Vladek and his point of view in a way that, and understand him in a way that that art clearly never does across these two books. But I don't think that there's ever really a concerted effort to do that. And I think the book, especially the second half of it, ends up being a lesser work because it's missing that perspective. I think not having anything really in Anja and Vladek's relationship, except for the courtship and the longing for each other while they're gone, is really there. And I think it's if there's one big piece that's missing to the book, it's that. It's a very incomplete picture of his family.
No, that's fine. Like hijacking as well. I actually was wanting to cover this off. I was thinking about covering off, and yeah, because it got me reading this was, yeah, you said about the courtship, and there was a lot of that at the beginning about Vladek's pursuit of her and entering into this wealthy family, and a lot built around Anya. And what sort of got to me as well was they show through Vladek's point of view how sensitive she was, because she obviously receives a letter from an ex-girlfriend of Vladek's, and
oh yeah, he starts with the whole "I banged a hot girl for 4 years and then I met Anja." Perspective we get at the beginning.
Yeah, actually, and also, yeah, he's quite mean about it, basically saying your mum wasn't someone to look at, like, you know, which is fairly terrible, really, to tell your son. Like, so, yeah. By the way, she's very lovely and everything.
By the way, you look like your mum.
Yeah.
that again, yeah, to jump back to that, then he does basically have a girlfriend for several years who is clearly his practice girlfriend before the one comes along that he wants. And
The only reason he didn't marry her is because she was poor.
Yeah, well, yeah,
she was poor and annoying. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And Anya comes along with a wealthy family, who their family owned a factory, and you know, it would be jump to conclusions here, but I'm assuming that there's an element of wealth went along with this marriage decision. And so we can see that she's sensitive and, yeah, like you say, the longing. But what I noticed was also what it felt to me was potential depression and mental health stuff that was around even before the war, you know, because she has a nervous breakdown at one point after the birth of her first child, who doesn't make it through the war. And so obviously Vladek has to support her with that. And then, you know, to jump forward, you know, because during the telling of Vladek's story, you don't see a lot of Anya, but his son is desperate to get to know about his mother, who he couldn't know because she kills herself in 1968. And then he's hounding his dad for her diaries. And then his dad later admits that he burned them all, or got rid of them all, which is extremely sad. And when they're separated during the Holocaust, in the concentration camps, like I was finding it even frustrating as a reader, not knowing really what was going on with Anya. There's just not a lot in there of her. Yeah, and we could obviously go online and read about her outside of this book, but I just didn't feel there was enough of the mother in the books. And for Mala as well, who is his second wife, what I didn't like was that she's a Holocaust survivor as well, and art doesn't ask her anything about her experiences. All you see her is as a second wife who Vladek just finds annoying.
He actively avoids trying to like communicate with her. Every time she's like, "You want to have coffee?" He's like, "Oh no, look at the time. I got to go. My bus is here." You know, like there's no attempt for him to welcome her into the family. And, you know, he's at this point, you know, he's half trying to reject his own father from being a part of this family for, you know, a multitude of reasons. But there's no, if anybody gets the short end of the stick here, it's Mala. She really gets treated like shit for the course of this book.
Yeah. It's almost like they're just kind of props, right? They, like, they don't have any real purpose other than to show that he had someone by his side. And at the sort of in the first part of the first book, sorry to say it, but like I thought he was kind of a dick because he just it just seemed to me like he didn't care much for anything that Anya had going on. Like he spent most of his time talking to her father, getting permission from her father to do things like on her behalf, as opposed to actually asking her like what she wanted to do, or if she did voice her opinion about something, he would tell her, oh, you're just being hysterical. And also I feel like Art doesn't get a pass either, because in the second book you find out that he ended up writing a comic about his mother's death, and he had he himself had some kind of mental breakdown and wound up in a mental hospital for about a month. And when he got out, that was after he got out, was when his mom committed suicide. And it's just kind of like you were old enough at that point to have formed your own relationship or some kind of solid relationship with your mother. Like I feel like you don't get to feel the way that you're feeling in the end, or like you can't get your hands on her stuff when you physically had her there and you could have asked her then, but you were too wrapped up in yourself to kind of take a minute to get her story.
Yeah, Art's very wrapped up in himself. You know, I feel like the only reason he introduces his wife at any point is just to like point out like, oh yeah, by the way, my girlfriend's not Jewish.
Yeah, like,
she became a Jew for me.
Yeah, he went into that explanation, and great, I was like, wait special. A minute, what? Like, he literally said, like, oh, I married you because you're French, and I never found Jewish women attractive. Like,
yeah, and she's like, well, I converted for you, and I'm like, well, why is that in here?
Yeah.
This sounds like a conversation for your marriage therapist, not your
Pulitzer
Prize-winning book.
I'm glad I'm not the only person that thought that. That just felt super out of place to me.
No, there's no agency given to the women in this book. And I get it that this story is a story about Vladek, but his relationship with Anya and Mala are so important in understanding who he was and who he became. And Art just has no interest in telling that story.
I thought there was a line in there between the father and son, between Mala and Art about why she felt that Vladek was with her, and he said something that she said that Vladek kept all of Anya's clothes, and she said took her to the wardrobe and said like, here are all my widow's wife's clothes, and she said, sometimes I only think the real reason he's with me is because we're the same size. and then Art said something like, oh, how primatic of my father, like and it's probably, again, just maybe how, because it shows throughout the book how tight he is. Did he just keep the clothes and go out and find a woman so he wouldn't need to buy them new clothes?
Having Mala around only lets Art like push his father into like really aggrandizing Jewish stereotypes. Like all he worries about is that Mala's going to take his money and moving to Florida. I mean, there's like the tropes of the elderly Jewish Holocaust survivor are kind of laid out in those last couple chapters in a way that's kind of antithetical to how the rest of his story is told. Like the rest of his story is really about the uniqueness of Vladek's experiences and how many circumstances he was able to survive. Mm-hmm. And then they're like, well, in the end, he just became every old, you know, bitter Jewish guy. And while there's an interesting connection to the trauma that happens and how that defined that entire generation, I don't think it plays very well when he's trying to tell stories about his family.
Yeah, I actually wrote that down because I thought the same thing. As you're reading the first book, it's kind of like, now, are you making a caricature of your father on purpose, or was your father actually this way? And then he even made a note on page 133, Art himself says, you know, in some ways he's just like the racist caricature of a miserly old Jew. And it was sort of a validation, like, so you're conscious that that's how he's coming off. Like, I don't know if he was actually that way, or you just, is that how you see him? So that's how you're writing him in this story.
And then he just puts up his hands and says, well, I said it. So
yeah,
that's it.
Exactly. Thanks, exactly. Guys. And it's almost like that's not really a confirmation. So I don't know. Parts of Vladek's story are really interesting, but then there are some parts where it's just like, you really are just kind of insufferable.
So, conscious of time, would you both feel that it's something that you've enjoyed reading? Would you read it again? And just what's your thoughts? I know, Randy, you've read it twice now, but, you know, sort of, did you enjoy it? And yeah, so Randy, you go first.
Yeah, I still find reading just about anything about the Holocaust really compelling, and especially now as an adult, revisiting a lot of stuff that I read between the ages of like 12 and 16 is... it's a very relevant time to be rereading these materials, I think. And, you know, while I certainly have a lot of issues with Maus and how it tells some of its story, I still think there's a really compelling effort made to bring life and try to, and by art, to try and understand his father in a way that circumstances never allowed them to. You know, what his father went through changed him as a person, changed the way he approached just basic human interaction. And we see that play out over and over and over again in the early 80s settings that were shown, to the late 70s. And I think art had a bit, it was very difficult for art to conceptualize the second half of this book once his father was gone and he had to kind of go off what he had left. And I think he really struggles to make that work. But as a way to build a living testament to your father's story, I think Maus is a really compelling piece of World War II, we'll say, creative nonfiction work.
What about you, Jasmine?
Yeah, I think, like I said earlier, the only other firsthand account I've ever read was Diary of Anne Frank, which tells a completely, completely different sort of story than what Maus is telling. It was definitely kind of eye-opening to see the firsthand account. Like, you've seen plenty of, you know, documentaries, or you've seen fictionalized movies about what happened, but sort of getting Vladek's firsthand account, especially of everything leading up to you know, the early 40s, where the war is getting into the nitty-gritty, I think being able to see it happened slowly over time was definitely a perspective that I had not had before. Would I read this again? Absolutely not. Once is definitely enough. But I feel like Randy said, I feel like there are plenty of parallels that you can draw between what happened then to the same kind of insidious behind the scenes things that are sort of happening now all over the world, not just in any one place. So I think it's important to kind of know history, know what happened, so that, you know, we can kind of do our best to make sure it doesn't happen again. But I mean, did I enjoy it? Yes. Was the story hard to read? Yes. Did I get any groundbreaking feelings or information from it? No, but I do see why it kind of won the accolades that it has won.
I think for me, I'm glad that I finally read it. It's been a book that I've always wanted to read, and because I guess it's length and content, I did pick this up a couple of years ago and started to read it, and it just took, you know, it went thing time and other things just got in the way, and it's been something I've always wanted to sit down and read. And I'm glad that I had this goal that we started this podcast, just giving myself that deadline to make sure it got read. I think it's actually a really important book, and it's made me reflect on my own family. And, you know, my two granddads were in World War II, one in the Navy and one was a Air Force pilot. I only met one of them, who died before I was about 6 or 7 or something like that, and both my Nan and my grandma never really wanted to reflect on the war. It was conversations that you just didn't talk about. And so what that was something that I quite liked about this, that Art managed to get those tales from his dad. And I think what you said earlier, Randy, about that obviously was very limited in book two, hence why I think he probably padded it out a little bit with his own life so he could have more content. I thought it's an important book to read. It's a book I enjoyed it despite its quite clearly horrible content. Would I read it again? I'm not entirely sure I would. It would probably be at least another 10 or 20 years before I could sit down and go through this again. But it's a book I'd recommend to people. I think it's a very important book to read about things that went on back then. And it has got me thinking. I just didn't really appreciate what people had to go through in those camps to survive. So, yeah. But anyway, Randy, thanks for joining us today for our first book club on Mouse, and as we work through a list of what people consider essential graphic novels, have you got anything coming up as well that you want to share with anyone and shout out your social medias and where people can find you?
Sure. Well, I already talked about what my show's doing, the Mid-Season Replacements, which you can find anywhere you listen to podcasts. And you can find me on Twitter at RJ Dank, usually talking shit about television, sports, and sometimes politics.
I know you Americans love your politics, so
it's usually not by choice. We have to.
Well, no, I care too, but I actually care about your politics probably as much as you do. Anyway, so next month, do you want it, Jasmine?
Yeah, so next month, our Late to the Party Book Club book, we're going to be reading Alan Moore's V for Vendetta. So get your copies of that and join us for a read.
What date will that come out?
We are dropping that on
well-timed.
5th of November.
Yeah, well-timed. So you can follow us on social media. And we're Geeks Unleashed on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.
And you can listen to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts, Google, Apple, Spotify, wherever. We're there. And also earlier today, actually, we dropped episode 18, where we did review Gangs of London and Utopia.
So thank you very much. You can join us next week for Geeks Unleashed episode 18. Have a good week.
Bye.
Thanks, guys.